Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe. Welcome back, Connor.
Thank you, Gabe. Yeah, we are back together again after the holiday break, coming into the new year, 2026.
Yeah.
Here we are. And as a result of that, Gabe is ripping. You can kind of hear it there.
Yeah, I'm getting a little antsy here. We got a couple letters from Beatrice that we opened at the end of last year. We also got one from Addressed to Science Unscripted. It's a long letter. Oh, man. Okay. Rita, we're going to read your letter next week.
Yeah.
We just opened it up and there's no way we have time to read this beautifully handwritten letter.
Yeah, calligraphy.
Yeah.
I will then hop right into another really nice email that we received. And to be clear, this was just before the holiday break at the end of 2025. The author of this email asked that I refer to her as Mary. And I'll say right at the top that it is connected to some science that I talked about on the show, where you can have functionally, you can create a more favorable opinion or feeling towards someone, somebody who you feel kind of neutrally about.
Mm-hmm.
If you close your eyes and imagine doing something positive with that person,
yeah,
and close your eyes and imagine that for at least 8 seconds. And what was interesting about that study was they had people doing this inside of a functional magnetic resonance imaging system so they could see the parts of the brain that...
Scanning the brain while they were doing this.
While they were doing this. And it resulted in them having more positive feelings toward the people where they'd imagined putting their feet in a river with these people, which
I loved
got
that.
A reaction out of you, Gabe.
I love that.
Other examples, I don't think I've mentioned them. Going to a beer garden with them, helping them move.
And this had a lasting effect after the fMRI segment. When they thought about this person later, they had a more positive opinion about that person.
I'm not sure they even examined it longitudinally. They were looking specifically at where the change happens in the brain.
Got it.
Was the focus of that study. But that is a good question. How long does it actually last? But in any case, one of our listeners put that into immediate practice. And she wrote in to say that my mom was diagnosed 2 weeks ago with stage 4 cancer, previously healthy. Our relationship has been toxic my whole life. For example, narcissism. But I'm the only surviving child, so I have to play a role here. She was discharged last week, and I finally decided I need to at least chat on the phone. 2 out of the 4 hospital visits I found devastating for the reasons above, so I was not looking forward to the call, but I'd gotten hints from family that some personal contact would be appropriate. To get myself, quote-unquote, in the mood, I applied the principles you mentioned. My mom definitely wouldn't fall on the neutral list, but I dredged up a couple of happy family memories and recalled those. I know it's technically not what they tested for, but I improvised. We ended up having a fairly pleasant conversation for almost 45 minutes. Then she really started aggravating me. But for those 40 minutes or so, we got along and had a quasi-nice chat for the second time in my life. So, thanks. Love your show, your banter, and the stories that almost always resonate pretty deeply with me.
Wow. Two guys talking about science on the other side of the world and the effect that can have on someone.
A 45-minute phone call. Happy for you, Mary. That is it. That is a great and creative way to take something, well, not theoretical, it was practical science, but to apply it to your own life in a way that... Sounds wonderful. I hope it had a lasting positive impact.
I got a real quick personal one as well from Arnie, and I'm not going to read the whole email. It's all about music, and it links with something I said last week when I talked very briefly about a New Year's resolution that I have. I want to learn the triads on the whole neck of the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Arnie took that and ran with it and wrote me this beautiful email about music. I'll save you it because it's a lot of, it's terminology.
Technical.
But thank you, Arnie, and I am going to... I'm going to do the things that you mentioned here, and let's see what happens with that, because it means a lot to me to get better at guitar. Okay? So thank you, Artie.
Last little email-related thing here. I received one from somebody calling himself Mango. Don't know if that's a real name or not. From Adelaide, Australia. Mango, I've read your email. I've listened to 2 of the 6 songs, Mango and 2 other guys. They create music based around wine science.
Wine science.
The science of creating wine out of grapes. And we have permission. We have Mango's permission to play
those songs?
To play those songs.
Yes.
I'm not quite there yet because, like I said, Mango, I've only listened to 2 of them. But next week, those songs are going to be on the show. So, yeah, get ready for those next week.
I'm going to kick us off with some data out of the United States. It's about COVID-19. And I know that this show, we used to talk a lot about that.
It was the only thing we did.
Exclusively about that. And we have not talked about it for a while. This is about how severe this disease still is or still was. This is looking specifically at 2023 to 2024. Mm-hmm. So this is CDC data. This is published in the JAMA Internal Medicine. Estimated burden of COVID-19 illnesses, medical visits, hospitalizations, and deaths in the U.S. from October 22 to September 24, right? In 2023, 43 million Americans were infected. 10 million went to the doctor. 1.1 million hospitalizations and 100,000 died from COVID-19 in 2023.
Okay, in a single calendar year.
So that was from October 22 to September 23. From October 23 to September 24, 33 million Americans got infected, 7.7 million outpatient visits, so went to the doctor, 879,000 hospitalizations, and again, 100,000 dead. So as a frame of comparison, at the height of the pandemic in 2021, there were 400,000 people who died. That was the cause of death. And last year, or sorry, in 2024 and 2023, it was at 100,000. So
it's still
very severe. Nobody talks about it. We don't talk about it. We went from 100% COVID to almost zero.
People don't want to talk about it.
We asked the listeners, should we keep doing this? And you said resoundingly no, and we listened to that. But still, this is a severe disease that is killing people, that is putting people in the hospital. And the bit of good news is that, so I talked about 23 and 24. In 25, now this is provisional data, also from the CDC. It's not official yet, but it says that 20,000 people died in 2025. Oh. So it is much better if that data turns out to be true. It's about a fifth as bad when it comes to fatalities as the 2 years prior. So that's good news. And just a little tiny little bit about the variant right now in question. It's called XFG. It's two different Omicron variants. And it is here in Germany called the Frankenstein variant. It causes razor blade throat, sore throat, headache, and cough. Those are the three symptoms. And at this point in time, if you were thinking about getting vaccinated, it is still a very good idea. The latest data, and this is from the EuroSave network here in Europe, it's 72% effective at preventing hospitalizations.
Mm, which is the relevant metric, the most relevant metric.
Exactly. So it still works. And that is from somebody that we talk to a lot, Bernd Salzberger, who is retired, is still looking into virological issues. So that data is good and clearly still effective. If you want to get vaccinated, the disease is still serious, but not as serious as before.
Yeah. And again, purely anecdotally, but at least here in Germany right now, it sure seems like people are not talking about being infected as much. Obviously, people have stopped largely with the nasal swabs. Yeah. If I suspect I have COVID-19, I still do that, but I think I'm in the minority there.
Yeah. There are no numbers. If you want to look at how many infections there are out there are no numbers because nobody's getting tested.
Yeah, yeah.
You get tested as soon as you're in the hospital and it's severe. That's where those numbers from the CDC are coming from, not from people sticking something in their nose and mouth like they did a few years ago.
Yeah, but for all of you out there listening, talk to your doctor. Ask your doctor about whether you should get vaccinated. Yeah. I believe we have very different policies in place around the world. Here in Germany, for example, Gabe, you and I would not be recommended for vaccination. That's been going on for a couple of years now.
Yeah. Yeah. One last bit of data. I think I know what you're going to say. The population that was affected way more than any other were the elderly. So above 65, nearly half of those infections that I talked about, roughly 2/3 of the hospitalizations and 80% of the deaths, those were people over the age of 65. So if you are over 65, then the question of vaccination becomes even more important.
Absolutely, yeah. And for everyone else out there, another way to stay healthy, and this is just the last little bit of science. We're running out of time here, but this was a study, University of Michigan, and it's about something. The reason I kind of latched onto it is I've seen a lot of people say this online, and I had never, ever seen a study on it. It's the idea that if one of your goals for 2026 is to exercise,
yeah,
and maybe stick. I mean, this is like the most common thing that people try to do and to really stick to it. A lot of people fail, and we've talked about that before on the show, but one sort of message or mantra that I've seen in the wild on the internet and comments everywhere is that good is better than perfect, or good is still good. meaning that a lot of people, I think I'm a classic case here. I always think to myself that if I'm going to strap on running shoes, then I'm not going to go 5K because for all the effort and then the shower afterwards, you get then
marathon.
And then you keep upping it. But then it starts to overwhelm you. Then you don't do it. So what they did at the University of Michigan is they took a look. It's a couple caveats here. Very small group of people. This is a kind of first look. 27 people. I think all of them except for two or just a handful are women and largely white. So that's one of the caveats with this. And it was just discussion-based. They had groups, I think four different groups, and they were talking to them. What happens to you and why don't you end up doing some of the things that you set out to do? And there were broadly four categories of reasons why people don't end up following or going through with what they want to do.
Yeah.
One is the one I kind of mentioned. Rigid, idealized exercise criteria lay the groundwork for a kind of all or nothing. So either I've got to go do this big thing or nothing at all.
Yeah.
They have all these quotes. I think about just under half of the people involved were college students. So one, Nina, said, if I do something for under 15 minutes, I feel like I didn't even exercise. Even if it had been dead out sprints, it just doesn't factor into my head like I did anything.
Got it.
This is part of the all or nothing thing that I was talking about. Another one, seeking excuses not to exercise. Just be aware if this is something that you, I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I actually have to clean up a little bit.
I got to go brush my teeth.
You're either going to go for an hour jog, but the 90-second teeth brushing blocks it.
Yeah.
Another thing is exercise is expendable. And there's one person, this is Jade, who says, I think exercise is expendable in my mind because if I plan to do laundry on Saturday and it doesn't get done, I know I have to do it Sunday. You know you have to do laundry or you have to go to the grocery store. You don't have to exercise. And the final one, as a category, I'm not sure I even really agreed with it, but it's called baffled by current inactivity in light of past exercise positivity. So basically the metric isn't perfection or 10 kilometers instead of 5 kilometers. It's your younger self.
Ah.
Where you're looking back, like, I used to be able to do that. And now am I really going to just go do a 5K? So all of those are those four reasons are why a lot of people end up failing.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, the title of the paper being The Secret Life of All or Nothing Thinking with Exercise. The idea here is that you should try not to think that way.
And you are pretty good at adhering to exercise goals. What is your tip for people out there on how to not fall victim to this all or nothing thinking?
I ran into work twice this week. That's more than I usually do. It's because it's the start of the year. That will drop off. It does drop off. But I have started shifting toward something like this. And it's not all or nothing. I think what I used to try to do is I would try to hit, I'd try to run too fast too often. And it burns up, your muscles need longer to recover when you do that. And so what I've done is slowed things down intentionally, tried to enjoy it more.
Make it fun.
Yeah. Make it about the distance and the time maybe, but not the speed. So dial one of the factors down a little bit, sleep. One thing I've realized about myself is if I've had a couple glasses of wine or a couple beers the night before, exercises the next day is probably just not going to happen. Mm. So I try to factor that in, go to bed. It's a lot of little things, and we all know ourselves better than anyone else. But yeah, these are the reasons a lot of people fail. And so 15 minutes is a lot better than zero. And lifting weights twice instead of three times or five times is a lot better than zero.
That's, it means you're going to keep doing it.
Yeah.
Right?
And that is the message. I mean, it was nice for me to hear again, and it's the message I just wanted to convey to all of you out there who are trying to get healthier this year and are worried that you might fail. This is one of the reasons it could happen, and maybe you can be okay with just doing some of the exercises some of the times.
Yeah, what do you guys have to say out there? Does it happen to you, the all-or-nothing thinking, or do you have any tips on how to avoid it?
Yeah,
we'd love to hear.
How do you keep exercising the way that you want to?
Or Arnie, how did you learn the entire neck on the guitar?
Yeah.
I want to know that.
SU@DW.com. Can animals feel? That's the first question. That's the easy question, I think, that we're about to get into. Can animals feel? The second question is a bit more complex. Can they think? Can animals think? And we're not about to give you that answer. I'm going to spoil that part right now. We can't give you that answer. It's not possible to give you that answer.
I would say during the interview, think for yourself about that question. Because that's what we're going to discuss when the interview is over. Can they feel and can they think like us?
Science Unscripted.
All right. Hi, my name is Katja Lieber. I'm based at Leipzig University and I'm a behavioral researcher. And together with a large team, we've just published a paper on the question if we can assign emotions and feelings to other animals.
Can we, Katja, can we humans assign emotions and feelings to animals?
Yes, we actually do, but it depends on how old you are. So the older we get, and that means kids starting from an age of about 4 years until they reach adulthood, they are much more likely, so the older they get, they're more likely to say, yes, other animals also have emotions. And with a little bit lower probability, they might also say, yes, they can think.
And universally, people kind of agree that one, they have emotions, and then two, that they think, that they're capable of thought?
Maybe. So we asked a large sample of people in many, many different places. So we investigated children and adolescents in 18 countries. They lived in more than 30 different villages or cities and other places. Already at an age of 4 years, they might say, yes, I think they have emotions and thoughts. But the older they get, the more likely kids become to say, yes, they have emotions and feelings. And as adults, it's almost 100% of people would say, yes, they do. However, if I may add, this is different when we ask, are these emotions and thoughts like those of humans? Then we get a completely different picture.
What is that picture? What does it look like, Katja? Are they think that they can think?
Yes.
Just not like us, not like I can.
Exactly. So if they said, yes, I think animals have emotions and thoughts, then we ask them, and are these thoughts and emotions like those of humans? And then the probability in answering yes to these two questions was much lower than to the initial two questions. Again, this doesn't mean they wouldn't say there isn't a chance that they think animals can feel and think like humans, but it was a much, as I said, a much lower probability. And maybe to add one more thing, the interesting question or the interesting thing about this answer was kids did not say, no, I don't think they can think like humans. But I remember the answer of one kid who said, I just cannot observe it. I don't know. I might be able to see if they feel specific emotions because I can see it, but I cannot see what they think. That's why I cannot answer the question. I cannot be 100% sure that they think like humans.
Was that kid wrong when he said that? Or what exactly do we know about the extent to which animals can feel and think?
If I would have an answer to this question, we don't know. It's thoughts is it's like a black box, right? I mean, you see there's a stimulus in the environment. We see this, we perceive this, we process it, and we act upon this. The same is true for animals. But what's happening in our head, even for humans, very, very difficult to investigate, specifically if you don't want to use invasive methods. So we still don't know what's going on in other animals' heads. We know that they can plan, that they make decisions. They know other group members, they remember them, have very good memory. But what they actually think, we still don't know because they don't have language. And some researchers say to be able to think, we need to speak.
I thought one of the more interesting findings or one of the more interesting differences between how, I think it was kids specifically, how they feel toward animals was dependent on whether they grew up rurally, kind of surrounded by some possible farm animals, I would say, and versus the urban kids, the city kids. Could you get into what that difference was?
The difference was that if you grew up in a rural area, then you were more likely to even say that animals feel and think in a human-like way. And this was particularly true for adults. And to be honest, this surprised us a little bit because we assumed in a rural area, you have a very close connection to other animals, specifically farm animals, but you also might need to kill them when you want to later on use them to eat them, for example. And that's why, and basically, an assumption in the academic world is we have to be able to kill someone, we have to distance ourselves from the specific species individual. And so very that the reason is that we, for example, we think cows are stupid and sheep, and the same is true for pigs, although they actually are cognitively very sophisticated. So that's why we were a little bit surprised to see this difference between urban and rural areas, that specifically adults were even more likely to assign human-like emotions and thoughts.
So I think what you're saying is the surprise there was that adults in rural areas who have direct interactions with these animals are able somehow to deal with that cognitive dissonance of thinking, yeah, this is an animal that has emotions, feelings, and thinks in a different way than I do, and yet I am going to kill and eat it.
Yeah, but to be 100% precise, we never asked them basically about specific animals, if they kill animals by themselves. We can only say for sure we had populations, including where we knew they raised their own farm animals, they had very close contact with them. We also had hunter-gatherer communities included that actually still, so they really hunt their own food and do not go to the supermarket and buy their meat as many of us do here in Western context. So we have to be careful because this is something we can only interpret as afterwards. We did not specifically investigate this.
Why did you study this particular topic? Why was it so important to you and for your team at the Max Planck Institute?
The whole project is a sheer coincidence, to be honest. I'm a biologist originally, so I work with non-human primates. All the species I work with are basically threatened by extinction. And so, of course, you question yourself, the research you're doing. So I study that gesture communication. Does it really help in a way to change the situation? At the same time, I've learned when working with kids in different cultural contexts, they treat animals very differently depending on where they live and the kind of relationship they have with them. And basically, this inspired the whole project to learn more about how the kinds of attitudes we as human beings have towards other animals, but also how we come to how they develop and how they might vary across different cultural contexts. And we started very small, two countries, Germany and Zambia, and then this has been growing and growing since, and we are not done yet.
Katya, do you believe that animals can feel and think?
Absolutely, yes.
Why?
Because when you work a lot with animals, you realize that humans as a species are not as special as we wish we would be. In terms of, I don't want to say we have all this when we build houses, we invent computers, we fly to the moon, and all these things other animals don't do. But in terms of how we act, how we make decisions, how we negotiate the social world, it's not that they are not navigate the social world. It's not that there are no differences, but very often it's not a categorical difference, like a qualitative one. It's more a matter of maybe humans are a little bit more complex in some of their behaviors, but the gap is not as big as some of us might wish.
And how do you observe it? What do you base that belief or knowledge on?
Yeah, this is also a very good question because we should not just assume and anthropomorphize, of course. Of course, this is not a result of one single study. I, by myself, do a lot of observations on facial communication, gestural communication. And for example, while I found the gestures in apes are very different compared to human gestures, facial communication is comparably very similar and basically evolutionary. We share many of our facial expressions with other primates. So this is just one little domain. This doesn't explain the complexity of their behavior. But again, many studies show, and also on their cognition, that the differences are not as big as previously assumed.
Every time I go to the zoo, it's usually the Cologne Zoo, and I see these masses of people stuffing their faces with French fries, or pommes, as Germans call it, and walking around and staring at these animals. Seriously, every single time, I ask myself, is this the best way to get people to care about animals that are basically alien and so far removed and distant to them that they would never interact with them otherwise? I guess part of the reason I'm asking that, or what reminded me, is you have an aquarium. Our listeners can't see this. You've got an aquarium behind you with fish. Yeah. Is seeing animals that we otherwise don't see the best way to get people, normal people, to care about those animals? Or what does the research show?
Again, a very, very good question. And this is actually a project we're currently planning. Because the idea is that, yes, you need this actually encounter with animals to get this idea of being fascinating, how amazing they are. So the idea is a movie or using internet, social media creates this impression you have when you actually encounter animal. On the other hand, the downside is direct contact might cause stress to the animal. In a zoo setting, they might not be able to express their nature behavior and so on. So we are currently planning to investigate with preschool children and also with young school children, so primary school children, which kind or which forms of interactions with other animals have which kind of impact. So are there any ways how the kids can encounter other animals that change, for example, their attitudes or the way they care for animals or the likelihood how much they would donate, for example, help, support another animal, depending on how they interact with them. So does it really matter if I see it in a real setting or in a captive setting or on a picture? And maybe as a last sentence to this, there are suggestions to get rid of zoos completely and make sure that we humans visit, for example, elephants, giraffes, great apes in their nature settings. But imagine what this would mean in terms of impact on the climate, flying around and the stress for the animals in their nature settings. So we have to be very careful. It's theoretically, that's a good idea. I think in reality, it causes a whole other lot of problems.
And that was Professor Dr. Katja Liebal. She was talking to us from Leipzig, from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology, where she's the leader of the Human Biology and Primate Cognition Research Group. So she knows a lot about this kind of stuff.
I cannot wait to hear what our listeners have to say when it comes to the question, how you know, or first of all, do you think that animals can think and feel? But more interesting is why, or how do you observe it? How do you know that your dog or cat or whatever can think and feel? Because I'm going to share my little bit right now. I know that Beavis can feel.
Beavis is your Dalmatian dog.
Beavis is my Dalmatian. I know that he can feel because a couple days ago, my wife and kids came back from a 5-day vacation in Berlin. And on the day they arrived, the morning they arrived, I told Beavis, Mama's coming home.
He doesn't understand that kind of language.
Hold on.
Mama's coming home?
If he doesn't understand it, then why did he started, I don't often use the word writhe. He started like writhing inside as soon as he heard the word mama, because he associates mama with Adrienne, my wife.
Who says?
And he loves her.
Okay, because you don't call your wife mama in front of your dog.
But
your kids do.
The kids call her mama, and he knows he associates mama.
Hey, Beavis, look, there's mama.
Mama's coming. He associates that term, M-A-M-A.
That's her name.
With her.
Yeah, that's her name for him.
Right? And I during those 5 days, I didn't say that word because I knew that what it would do to Beavis. I said it that morning. He started writhing, trembling inside. He was so excited.
Right.
Although, I don't even have to mention what he does when she arrives.
Yeah.
That's the feel part. I don't think he can think because I sometimes talk to him at night about my feelings and thoughts, and he just has no response to any of that.
Well, I think 200 is the number I have in mind. 200 words, roughly, the number of words a dog or possibly certain species of dogs can record and connect to an action or an object.
Yeah.
And so your stream of consciousness at 2 in the morning is probably just very comforting sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
he just stares blankly at me.
So. Yeah. back to all of you out there. What do you think, or as Gabe said, what do you know deep inside of you? And why do you know it? Let us know at su@dw.com.
Science.
DW, made for minds.